Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Scientists and public health experts say that the only way to stop the COVID-19 spread is to quickly develop, produce, and distribute a vaccine. The World Health Organization reports that more than 100 different vaccines are in development, with a number of human clinical trials underway around the world, including in the United States. In the U.S., human trials are well underway, with the pharmaceutical giant Pfizer being the latest to join the race for a vaccine. But when and how the right vaccine will be produced, let alone circulated to enough people, is unclear. Jared Hopkins covers the pharmaceutical industry for the Wall Street Journal. Welcome to the show, Jared.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Is a pandemic good for the business of pharmaceuticals?
It's very unique, I guess, for them, because it's been all hands on deck for many companies putting resources towards this, with an unclear sort of result or future of how things might pan out. I mean, traditionally, vaccines and public health has not always been at a leading priority for some pharmaceutical companies, although they do make many of the vaccines that are routinely taken by Americans and others.
So what is the incentive for them to invest in research for a vaccine? Is it just the goodwill they engender, or it looks bad not to?
Well, many of them have said that there is a goodwill component to this, and that a lot of the large companies that we know by name, such as Johnson & Johnson and Pfizer, have a lot of the manufacturing capability that's needed to produce millions to hundreds of millions to billions of doses because of the scale, and that if they can risk doing some of this, that maybe smaller companies and university researchers might not be able to do. Johnson & Johnson, for example, has said that they are going to price a potential vaccine in a nonprofit sort of way. Not every company might be able to do something, under that sort of scenario.
What is the role of the Food and Drug Administration in the process of developing a vaccine? What if the vaccine ends up coming, the magic one comes from Germany or wherever?
Yeah, so typically vaccines are developed and they're tested and then ultimately receive license by the U.S. Regulatory agencies, including the FDA. They would approve a vaccine. What's going on, though, is that because of the urgency, and there is no approved treatment or approved vaccine yet, is that they might potentially be available on what's called an emergency use, and that's in which the FDA would grant on a sort of a temporary basis for a vaccine to be available as soon as for the pandemic, and that could be as early as the fall, according to some companies, that they are aiming for the fall for a vaccine to be available on what's called this emergency basis. The FDA did an emergency authorization on a similar way for a treatment recently for what's called remdesivir by Gilead Sciences. So they'd be looking at a sort of a similar scenario.
Right. The way I read it, it was Johnson & Johnson and some others hope the trials start in September, and they're looking for a distribution of an emergency use only in 2021. What does emergency use only mean, though? Is it only certain people get it, like the most vulnerable, that kind of a thing? Or is it, do they go to the hot spots? What does that mean?
Yeah, the best way to think about it is it's not an outright approval. It's sort of a approval before the approval.
Okay.
In which the FDA would approve something, authorize this on an emergency way, and there would be limitations. So it's unclear sort of how that would work out, but the expectation from talking to experts is that it would go to frontline healthcare workers, emergency responders, people who are most vulnerable in that capacity, and these are healthy people who don't have the virus, and that's how it would be worked. Meantime, while that use is approved, clinical testing would continue. An important thing to remember here is that typically a vaccine takes more than 10 years to be developed It goes through testing of tens of thousands of people. And here, what an emergency use authorization would come much, much, much earlier. It would come after testing of maybe hundreds or thousands of volunteers, but not nearly on the scale of a typical vaccine.
That 10 years to be developed time frame, is that pretty typical for lots of things when it comes to pharmaceuticals?
Yes. Okay. Yeah. So most drugs and vaccines that start fail, either because they are proven to not be effective or proven to have some sort of toxicity or safety issue. And vaccines take very long, in part because of the development process, but because of also the testing and the population sizes that they are typically tested in. Typically, experts want to get a wide geography, a demographic of testing results. And that's often a contributing reason for that. Also, typically in drug development and vaccine development, it's a slow process, right? Like anything, sometimes when you're dealing with science. So you design the study, you wait a little bit, you test the vaccine, then you wait for the results, then you analyze the results, you release them at maybe a large medical meeting, and you wait a couple of years, mm-hmm. and there's funding issues. There's all these sort of moving targets and processes that goes on. There, everybody is sort of expediting all those sorts of things. I mean, one of the interesting things that's going on with Pfizer, for example, is that they will be monitoring in real time their vaccine testing move it quicker and stay on top of it. And that's not necessarily always what happens.
So what is real time? What does that mean?
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah,
so that means that basically they will be able to see how the vaccine is performing in patients. And as the patients the patients will be keeping track of basically their symptoms, or uh-huh. if they develop any symptoms, and they're in like an electronic diary, like a journal, I guess,
uh-huh.
and will be submitting those sort of results to researchers. And then Pfizer will be able to see those results from researchers on a regular basis. And part of that is because Pfizer is developing or testing four vaccine candidates, potential vaccines, and at different doses. And so they're saying what their hope is in this real-time sort of review is that they can say, oh, wait, this one dose, it's not working. Let's just take it out. Or this other dose, it might prove to be a potential safety issue. Let's take it out. And so they're going to rejigger this and adapt in as the trial is going on. And that's, again, something that is not always typically done, but uh-huh. that companies and researchers are trying to do, given the urgency of this situation.
So we read that there's more than 100 candidates being studied around the world now for a vaccine. Is there any obligation or any requirement or any incentive for them to collaborate, to talk to each other, or is that a given that they already are?
So there is a lot of collaboration going on, and the companies say we're not rivals, we're all into this together. One area of collaboration is that governments are providing a lot of financial assistance to these companies for some of this development. Also, interestingly, companies have said that they will share manufacturing facilities. Pfizer has said that it will open up if it has space for another vaccine or drug development. They can come in and use some of their space. Companies are sort of collaborating in a way like that sometimes you don't always typically see, clearly, because a lot of these companies have competitive products, right?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I mean, as far as that goes, are they... Are they so? I'm wondering about where they're getting the people from because we're all supposed to stay home. I mean, I know the shutdowns are opening up, but is that posed any kind of particular problem for them, given the expedient the way they're expediting this, but that's still among us?
Yeah. So there are a number of people. I mean, I've spoken with some volunteers who have enrolled in these trials, and they say they want to do their part. They want to contribute. They want to help. And they also say, hey, I don't want to get this virus, and I want to try to see if this vaccine works. People are hungry for a solution, for some way out of this. Interestingly, though, you bring up the lockdowns and the stay-at-home orders, is that there are some researchers who are concerned that, ironically, in a way, if a lockdown works so well, does that mean that then someone with the vaccine in a trial is not exposed to the virus, which is what, in order to test the vaccine, you have to be exposed to potentially to that virus, right, to see if the vaccine prevents you from getting it.
Well, I wondered if that was a facet of all of this, is that they were artificially exposed or, exposed in a premeditated way. But that's not the case. They can't do that. That's unethical, right?
Well, there is something. So what that's called is those are called, challenge trials is what they're called, where someone is vaccinated and deliberately exposed to the virus then. And that is something that researchers are considering and that they're looking at. It's been done in the past in limited cases. The difference here, as researchers say, is that in the past, well, you've exposed it to a virus that maybe that we're familiar with or we know about, and you're testing a vaccine that way. Here, they caution that we don't know a lot about this virus. We don't really know what level of immunity you need. We also don't really know if any of these vaccines are going to provide enough duration. Maybe you need to get one or two shots. And these are all being the questions that are being explored right now.
That's kind of the underlying problem to all of this, all of the rush. It could backfire, right? Because we don't know enough.
Yeah, and that's a big question mark here. When you're doing testing in a vaccine, if you find a side effect in a 0.01% of the population or 0.1% of the population, that sounds really small. But as scientists have told me, you know, you do a simple math. If you're testing 10,000 or 70,000 people, that 0.1% gets pretty high pretty quickly. And then a safety issue or a side effect then could be quite concerning. And that's one of the main issues that are being explored right now.
Is the intense focus on a vaccine at this point in competition with developing treatments for the virus?
Yeah, they're not really in competition because there's a big distinction is that treatments and drugs are used to treat patients who have the symptoms or are diagnosed, and a vaccine is used to prevent contracting that disease. So you're, in a way, you're sort of trying to recruit different patients.
Okay.
Now, a caveat to that is that sometimes drugs are viewed as prophylactic or as preventative, and there is a theory that, for example, a type of treatment called as an antibody, that could potentially be a preventative way. But generally, you're looking at health, you're looking at different patient populations where vaccines are trying to recruit healthy volunteers and treatments are being tested on patients who are sick already.
Jared Hopkins, thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Jared Hopkins is a reporter for The Wall Street Journal. He covers the pharmaceutical industry. We're going to continue our conversation on What about a vaccine, how it comes about, what goes into producing one? Coming up and later in the program, if you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Scientists and public health experts say that the only way to end the COVID-19 pandemic is to develop, produce, and distribute a vaccine ASAP. Linda Safe is a professor in the Food Animal Health Research Program at Ohio State. Her coronavirus research spans four decades and focuses on pathogenesis, immunity, and vaccines for animal coronaviruses. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Dr. Robert Frank is director of the Gamble Program for Clinical Research at Cincinnati Children's Hospital Medical Center, where he is also the principal investigator for the Vaccine and Testing Evaluation Unit, one of four sites participating in a COVID-19 vaccine trial in the U.S. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Dr. Frank, how much does it play into all of this, the fact that the virus is so new to us and that as a society, the worldwide, there's not a lot known about it?
Right. Well, I mean, that's why it's called the novel coronavirus, is because this is the first time humans have seen the coronavirus. And because of that, all of us are susceptible to the infection. And that's why we're having this pandemic, so many people becoming infected.
But as far as developing a vaccine for it, how much does the fact that it's so new and we don't know that much about it and the diseases it causes, for instance, how does that play into developing a vaccine?
Well, so one of the nice things about viruses is that they don't have a lot of genetic machinery, so that they're not nearly as complex as other organisms. And also, we've had tremendous advances in molecular biology. And so now the very clever and smart scientists have sequenced the genome of the virus, so we know which pieces of the virus make the different parts of the virus. And for the vaccine that we'll be looking at, and also one that Moderna is looking at that the NIH is sponsoring, we're taking a piece of the genetic material called the mRNA for the spike protein, and then that's what's going to be used as the vaccine. So our body then will be making the spike protein, and then our body makes an immune response to it. So that the advances in science that we've had over the last generation really have allowed us to have incredibly faster response to vaccines than we would have had in the past.
Right. And does the speed with which a vaccine is being pursued this time, do you see that changing our expectations or the potential for development in the future?
Right. I mean, you know, so possibly. So that there's been, so BARDA, which is a biodefense from the agency of the U.S. government, has been talking about pandemic response for a long time and is looking to actually kind of have a stockpile of vaccines using a similar kind of technology against other viruses that have pandemic potential. So, yes, I mean, this really could be something where it changes the way we're looking at making vaccines.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about how vaccines are developed right now. That's Dr. Robert Frank of Cincinnati Children's Hospital Medical Center, where he is director of the Gamble Program for Clinical Research, and he oversees the Vaccine and Testing Evaluation Unit. Also with us, Linda Safe. She's a professor and coronavirus researcher at Ohio State. If you have questions or comments for either of them, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Professor Safe, your research focuses on animal coronaviruses. How does that play a role in finding a vaccine for humans?
So many of these coronavirus infections cause similar syndromes in animals. So we have some that cause respiratory disease in animals, so we can follow how those vaccines were developed and are most effective as a somewhat of a model for vaccines in humans. We also have lots of vaccines for animals that some are for systemic coronavirus infections, some are for enteric coronavirus infections. So depending on the overall way that the SARS coronavirus 2 causes disease, we can apply some of our animal coronavirus models to understand the pathogenesis of the virus and then the most effective vaccine designs to deal with these different aspects of the infection.
And when you talk about pathogenesis, you mean how it travels through the body? It sickens us?
Yeah. Okay. Pathogenesis, we mean how it actually causes disease in the host. And we're seeing with the SARS coronavirus 2, this pathogenesis appears to be extending beyond the respiratory tract. So we're going to have to look at all the facets of how the virus causes disease and make sure the vaccine can protect against all those different parameters.
Are there coronaviruses in animals before that have done that in the same way?
So we've had aspects of several of these in animals. The one in cattle causes both respiratory and enteric disease, and it looks like in a fair proportion of the patients, both for SARS and the SARS coronavirus 2, there may be an enteric disease component, meaning infection of the gastrointestinal tract and shedding in the stool. So we do have that as a model system to try to understand, again, how the coronavirus is infecting both the respiratory tract, the lung, and the intestinal tract.
So when you say systemic and enteric, what's the difference between systemic and the gastrointestinal aspects of enteric?
So systemic, there is actually an infection in cats. It's called feline infectious peritonitis virus. And this can infect cells of that play a role in the immune response, particularly a type of cell called macrophages. And this spreads by way of the bloodstream of the cat to different target organs, but especially the immune cells. So this causes a severe disease, and that's the name of the disease, feline infectious peritonitis, and it's pretty much invariably fatal in cats. And although they've worked for many years for a vaccine, this is similar to HIV that also infects immune cells. So they have not yet been successful in a vaccine for FIPV in cats.
Dr. Frank, when the virus was first noted, I guess back in November, maybe December, whenever that mm-hmm. was. Mm-hmm. Is it people like you that sort of hop to and start trying to collect the literature that might help you address it?
Sure. Well, so that's one of the jobs that the CDC does, our Centers for Disease Control, is that just like the name says, disease control, is that many of the people at the CDC are epidemiologists, so that they study epidemics, and that's one of the things that was done as far as that when there were cases, people started studying it to try to understand the infection, to try to understand who's at risk, how it's passed, get a case definition so that we can understand the disease better. So, yes, that was what people started to do pretty quickly, and that's why it raised the awareness very high very quickly, because people saw how infectious as was and what the potential was for the whole world.
What do we know about, I mean, and what does it have to do with the vaccine, if anything, the infectiousness of a virus?
So the reason that you want to get a vaccine is that you're trying to prevent people from getting infected. So the social distancing is what we're doing now as far as it's a short-term solution. And it works as long as people follow it and use their masks and use their hygiene and they're washing their hands. Those measures work, but it's something that's hard for people to do for the long term. And so that's why we're really pivoting to have a vaccine in conjunction with the social distancing. As far as the looking at trying to prevent a disease, to me, the higher mortality there is, the more likely it's going to pass from other people would help us to decide which ones we're going to look at trying to get a vaccine. So if you have a common cold, it would be great if we could have a vaccine and no one would get a cold. But even if you get a cold, you get over it and it's okay. Whereas if you have something like Ebola, where the mortality is 50 to 70%, it's very important to have a vaccine to prevent that, because if somebody gets infected, we don't have good treatment and there's a very high mortality. The COVID-19, right now, our mortality rate for case fatality, if you meet the definition, is somewhere between 1 and 5%. It really depends on where you are in the world. It depends on what your risk factors are and that. So it's not like Ebola, but flu, on the other hand, is about 0.1% mortality. So it's about 10 to 50 times higher than flu mortality.
But when you look at certain groups, it's much higher.
That's correct. I mean, and one of the things that I think that has been uncovered, or, you know, people knew, but it is really kind of brought to light, is the social disparities and the medical disparities here, is that if you look at the people of color, is that over half of the deaths have been in people of color, where that percentage of the population is under 25%. So that it's 2 to 3 times higher in that population. It's not because of a underlying genetic problem. What it is because of the access to medical care as far as chronic diseases that aren't being addressed well, and so that then puts you at risk for having more severe illness.
Yeah, it's really interesting how this disease has laid bare a lot of gaps in our society. Professor Saif?
Yes.
You don't have those same, all things being equal, you don't have those same disparities in research animals, right?
So in terms of, are you talking about in terms of animal models or in terms of vaccines for livestock?
In terms of animal models and how that works.
So actually, in terms of the SARS coronavirus 2, that's a very critical issue, is trying to find an animal model that can reproduce a similar disease in humans. And that's part of the problem in terms of one of the phases of the vaccine testing, that in one of the phases you should test the vaccine in animal models, make sure that it's safe, but also look for immune responses and effectiveness. So there are quite a few models projected right now, and unfortunately we don't have any model that's projected for testing the vaccine that completely reproduces the pneumonia that we see in humans. So that is a concern.
And what do you understand why that is?
It likely has to do with how well that virus is adapted to these other animal species. So in other words, it's transmitted now in humans and it's very effectively transmitted. It could be that in some of these animals, they have a more active innate immune response, which is the first track against the vaccine to try to keep the virus from spreading in the body. That's possible, and especially in terms of being so severe in elderly patients and patients with comorbidities. So one of the most widely used models for the SARS coronavirus, the original SARS coronavirus, was an aged mouse model.
Okay.
And they adapted the virus in the mouse so it would be more pathogenic in the mouse, and then that proved to be a better model. So we may be looking at various alternatives like that, or using some of these comorbidity factors to show a more severe clinical disease.
Yeah, Dr. Frank?
So I was going to say, and one of the things is that there are some organisms that just are specific to different animals, or humans. So, like, there's some infections that only infect humans. And because of that, we have to do our research in humans. So that for norovirus, for example, which is a diarrheal disease, there is a an animal model that's not great, but in baby pigs. But otherwise, we have to use humans. Shigella, which is another bacterial infection causing diarrhea, pretty much is just in humans. So the COVID, we think, probably came from an animal that was then able to get into the human population. But that's one of the problems with animal models is sometimes you have a infection that just won't infect other tissues or other animals.
Could I follow
on
to that? So the follow-up I'd like to make for that is that there is evidence, though, that this virus, the human strain, does infect animals. It infects, in fact, experimentally ferrets. Also, there's some reports that it can infect hamsters. We know there can be occasionally spillover in the pets, particularly cats. We knew in the zoo it infected some felids species. And then there are some reports now in mink farms in the Netherlands. Now, so far, all of these cases appear to have transmitted from humans that were in close contact with the animals, and the animals had repeated exposure. So right now, the animals do not appear to transmit to other animals or from one animal to the other or back to humans. But if this circulates widely in other animal species, we don't know if there could be some animal reservoirs eventually. So some of these species may actually be initially effective models, but as Dr. Frank said, they may not recapitulate the full disease process, and that's been a problem all along with animal models. There's really hardly any that have recapitulated the full disease in humans.
What do you mean by animal reservoirs?
So when the virus gets into a certain population, and I guess an example is bats, there are a lot of bat species, and there are a lot of coronaviruses that seem to have some propensity to infect certain species of bats. So those coronaviruses that are in the bats, and this has happened apparently over centuries or maybe even eons, they do not really cause disease in the bats, and we do not really understand why that is, but ideally more research should be done on this to understand how some species can combat these infections without disease. So anyway, we now know that those coronaviruses are in the bat reservoir, and they constantly circulate among various bat species. So this is what a host reservoir means. It means when the virus establishes itself in the species, and it then is part of the ecology of bats.
We are going to continue our conversation. That is Linda Safe. She's a professor and coronavirus researcher at Ohio State University. Also with us, Dr. Robert Frank. He's director of the Gamble Program for Clinical Research and oversees the Vaccine and Testing Evaluation Unit at Cincinnati Children's Hospital Medical Center. If you have a question or comment about how the virus, how the vaccine is being developed or vaccines, there's more than 100 being developed around the world, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Scientists and public health experts say that the only way to end the COVID-19 pandemic is to develop, produce, and distribute a vaccine as soon as possible. And that's what we're talking about today. Still with us is Dr. Robert Frank. He's director of the Gamble Program for Clinical Research at Cincinnati Children's Hospital Medical Center, where he is also the principal investigator for vaccine and testing for the Vaccine and Testing Evaluation Unit, which is one of four sites participating in a COVID-19 vaccine trial in the U.S. Also, Linda Safe. She's a professor at Ohio State's Food Animal Health Research Program. Her coronavirus research spans four decades, focusing on pathogenesis, immunity, and vaccines for animal coronaviruses. If you have a question or comment, now's the time. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Dr. Frank, I'm wondering how you choose candidates to participate in the human trials at this point. Is there an age limit? Do they have to be healthy? How does that work?
So for any vaccine or for any research study, we have what are called inclusion and exclusion criteria. And so the inclusion means you have to have all these to be able to be eligible, and the exclusion means you can't have any of those or you're excluded. So for the first part of the study, we're going to be looking at people 18 to 55 years of age that are in generally good health, so that we will do screening labs. We'll be looking at if they've had COVID before. We're doing both a PCR and serology to be looking to see if they've had the COVID-19 before, because if they do, we would exclude them. But as we're moving through the phases, that the inclusion will be less restrictive as we gain more information about the safety and the immune response to the vaccine.
Why exclude them if they've had COVID-19 before or have the antibodies for it?
Because that would be presumed that you're already immune, and so that then you really would be having a hard time to see if the vaccine were doing anything if you already have pre-existing antibodies.
Right, and that's a big question out there about whether or not exposure equates with immunity.
So, you know, that will be interesting. So that the coronavirus is an RNA virus, and one of the things where it's important as an RNA virus is that they have the ability to change a lot more than DNA viruses. So a flu is an RNA virus, and that's why we need to get a flu shot every year, because the virus changes a bit every year, or sometimes can have big shifts. And so that's why we need a vaccine every year. I wouldn't be surprised is that the coronavirus, this COVID-19, may become part of our routine vaccine series.
I mean, it'll be mutating and changing, and we'll just have to keep updating the vaccine on it.
That's possible, yes.
Just to follow up on that, and so a concern with these viruses is that even with the common cold and the challenge studies that were done many years ago, people only have immunity for about a year based on the challenge studies. And also, though, once that they had some degree of immunity and they were challenged with virus, the disease was, even though they became reinfected, the disease was less severe, and they shed a much shorter period.
Right.
So that would be the best-case scenario that we would hope for. But because these immunity wanes for SARS and MERS about 2 to 3 years, it's very likely that we will need booster vaccines, maybe not annually, but every 2 to 3 years to keep our immunity at a level that would be protective. And so that would be similar to influenza, but maybe not as annually as it was for influenza.
I agree.
Yeah. There is the anti-vaccine movement in this country, as you both well know, I'm sure, and there's always a question about why vaccines have to have any toxicity in them at all. What is it about a vaccine that can be dangerous? Dr. Frank, given the fact that we need to vaccinate as many people as possible to, you know, at least get close to closing the loop on this, what are your concerns about that, and how do you respond to the issue of toxicity in vaccines?
Well, so one of the things, as far as if you, so that's kind of a whole another hour of discussion.
I know.
But the you know, if you look at the adverse event profile of vaccines that we have in pediatrics, is that it's actually extremely good, and that the risk benefit ratio is extremely good, as far as that the risks are low and the benefits are really high. If you, as far as that the of all the preventive measures we do, the ones that have the most effect on the society is vaccines. Hand washing is close, but that vaccines really have had the most effect on decreasing human illness. That the a lot of times people are talking about impurities, and that, you know, that they're really a lot of times that they're mistaken on things, and that as far as with the vaccines that they're looking at now for these mRNA vaccines, is that there's no preservatives in them. They're single dose vaccines they're using, that they're and that there's not the thimerosal or things that people have talked about, even though thimerosal has no association with autism.
Mm-hmm.
That these vaccines should be okay, and that but that's why we're testing things, to make sure that there aren't side effects, and that in the end, you know, we're looking at, again, everything we do in life is a risk-benefit ratio, as far as looking at what our risks are of something and then what's the potential good that can come out of it.
Professor Yousef,
So I think all these points are highly important. And I think what's so important in this disease, we have a fatal disease. Some diseases, you know, you may be very, very sick and you eventually recover, but here we have a lot of fatalities. So it, and we do not yet have good antivirals or other means for treatment.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very important, I think, in terms of population immunity overall, to have vaccine, because again, this also relates to herd immunity. If enough people get the vaccine, you will actually, even if it's not 100%, if it's high enough percentage, you will also protect those who are highly susceptible, or people like who are immune compromised who cannot get the vaccine. So this is a critical component of vaccines for public health.
As far as the enough, when is enough enough, and when do we achieve the herd immunity level, is that pretty much the same for all? Any vaccine out there that the herd is the same. It's the vaccine that changes. It's not
right. And so it's about, so the numbers are around 80%. And the comments as far as for the vaccine, I couldn't have said that any better. As far as that, why it's so important to do this,
right.
And that you know, just as an aside, it gets off the topic a little bit. You know, there was some comments. People said, well, you know, you should purposely infect your children with COVID-19.
Oh yeah.
And one of the things there, as far as it sounds like a good idea in the first place, but if you think about it, we have 80 million people in the United States below 18 years of age. And if even only 25% of them became infected, that's 20 million people. And that the thought right now, the model is about 1 out of 2,500 people, kids, that get COVID would end up in the intensive care unit. So with 20 million people, that ends up over 100,000 people in 100,000 kids in the intensive care unit. And so sometimes these things where people think, you know, going out and giving yourself the infection, like, you know, giving a chickenpox party and that would be a good idea, that would not be a good idea, because if it's done on a large scale, it's going to have a lot of kids get sick. And then the problem is, too, these kids aren't in a bubble. they have to be taken care of by their parents or their grandparents, and so that now you're transmitting the virus to high-risk groups, and so that you're going to really increase their mortality.
Which has always been, to me, the reason, the logic behind closing the schools. It wasn't about necessarily, you know, obviously you want to protect the kids, but it's about their carriers.
Yes.
And also, we still don't know the full effects of the virus. Now, there's this mystery disease coming
the
out of it.
Kawasaki disease.
Yeah,
the
like
syndrome.
Yeah, and it presents once or twice a year in some emergency rooms. And one in New York, it's been 40 or something cases in the last month. So we still don't know everything about how it affects children.
Yeah, and I think the problem is, as this virus spreads and we're learning more and more about the pathogenesis or how it causes disease, we are seeing some other side effects that hadn't been recognized before. Now, historically, at one time, there was thought to be an association between one of the common cold, the more recently discovered ones, and the Kawasaki disease. That wasn't proven to be statistically the same risk, but I think it shows that there are some side effects that could occur in certain segments of the population that we hadn't anticipated. And once we have a higher percent infected, we start seeing some of these other side effects that we weren't aware of.
Does the understanding of the pathogenesis, Dr. Frank, inform you in developing a vaccine, or is it has more to do with whether it's RNA and that kind of a thing?
So the pathogenesis helps us more to understand the spectrum of illness, about how sick somebody can get and which tissues get infected, but it really doesn't affect us that much as far as making a vaccine.
Okay.
The vaccine, what you want for a vaccine is that you need to know what is what's called your protective antigen, so that what antibody you need to make, because like we looked at HIV vaccines, there's some of the initial HIV vaccines that they were very good at stimulating antibodies, but the antibodies weren't protective, so that it didn't keep people from getting HIV. So that's what we really need to know with a vaccine, is against what antigen do we need to make the antibody? And that's, we think the spike protein is the important one, but that's the thing to be testing.
Is that, go ahead.
Yeah, just a follow on. Because I'm a mucosal immunologist, so we do have some experience with vaccines in terms of viruses that infect the mucosal sites, and that includes like the respiratory tract or the intestinal tract.
Mm-hmm.
So we do know that there are two types of influenza vaccines. One is inactivated and given intramuscular. And so you can get antibodies that target the right targets of the virus that also then are transported to the lung and help protect the lung. But the other scenario is for upper respiratory tract infections, there's also a live attenuated flu vaccine that's given intranasally.
Uh-huh.
This targets a different type of antibody. They're called immunoglobulin A antibodies, and they're especially protective at mucosal sites against mucosal infections. So we do have different scenarios here, and we won't know until we do the experimental studies which scenario is the best case vaccine and also route to give the virus.
Are vaccines in their nature, and I hope I'm asking this the right way, prophylactic? They protect against or attack the virus if it enters the body?
So right now all our vaccines are prophylactic.
Okay.
There are some vaccines where we're looking at a therapeutic. There are some against herpes simplex that they're looking at for therapeutic. But right now, basically, our vaccines are prophylactic to prevent you from getting an infection.
Professor Safe, earlier this year you cited U.S. planning as a reason we could be spared a large-scale infection. Have you been surprised at how the coronavirus has spread?
So I think I've always tried to raise danger signals for this virus with what we know in animal populations. We have had several major coronavirus epidemics fairly recently, especially in swine. The one killed about 8 million baby piglets because it targets the intestinal tract and is deadly in neonates.
Okay.
So what is so worrisome about this virus is how quickly it spreads and transmits from human to human, and we don't really understand the reason for that yet. But breaking this chain of transmission and using vaccines to do that is critical, and that's one way to stop this chain of transmission. So I think, you know, we've always, as coronavirologists, been concerned that this could be the next pandemic, just like SARS coronavirus was.
And Dr. Frank, we're just about out of time, so I need a really quick answer to something that I know is complicated. But given the stay at home and the people who are staying at home to avoid getting it, does that affect the impact of a vaccine going forward?
No, they're hand in hand.
Okay. So it won't, and as far as studying the vaccine, you can still study one and develop one with people staying home and staying safe.
It's a two-prong approach. The short term is social distancing, and then the long term is the vaccine, is the way I see it.
Okay. Well, to you both, I know we've just scratched the surface in your world. In our world, we thank you very much, Dr. Robert Frank, director of the Gamble Program for Clinical Research and oversees the Vaccine and Testing Evaluation Unit at Cincinnati Children's Hospital Medical Center. Thank you so much.
You're so welcome.
And Professor Linda Safe, she studies corona for 4 decades now as a coronavirus researcher at Ohio State University. Thank you so much, Professor Safe, for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
That's it. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.